Okay, hello everybody. And I would like to thank the organizers very much for inviting me to this nice conference, and I'm really enjoying the discussions here. And now I'm going to talk about an experiment where we have the goal to produce rubidium strontium ground state molecules. And I will report on two steps which bring us closer to this goal, namely the production of a rubidium strontium double Bose-Einstein condensate and the creation of strontium 2 molecules by stirrup. Let me introduce you to strontium a little bit. This is the optical term scheme, similar to the optical term scheme that Deep showed of ytterbium. And the singlet triplet term scheme provides us with broad line width transitions, narrow line width transitions, meter stable states with lifetimes on the order of minutes, and a ground state that does not have an electronic magnetic moment. Now, if you have a quantum gas out of an strontium or another alkaline Earth-like atom, you can do things with it that you can't do with other quantum gases. And here is a brief overview of some of the ideas. For example, we can study interesting many-body physics, for example, SUN magnetism, which is a special type of magnetism. We have nice ways to create artificial gauge fields, which can help us to understand phenomena related to the quantum Hall effect. And there are plenty of other ideas, quantum computation schemes, precision measurement. We have developed a scheme with which we can probably create a truly continuous Bose-Einstein condensate and much more. But today I'm interested in all those things, but today I will talk about rubidium strontium ground state molecules. Those molecules are polar open shell molecules. They have an electric dipole moment of 1.5 debye and an unpaired electron. Now, this electron enriches the spin structure of the molecule and provides the molecule with a magnetic moment. Now, we have two handles with which we can influence the molecule, the electric dipole moment and the magnetic dipole moment, and that provides us with a huge parameter space for the control of these molecules. A simple example is we can confine these molecules in a magnetic trap. Yeah? And this is not possible with d-alkali ground state molecules. Or we can create potentials that depend on the orientation of the electron spin. It will also be very interesting to study the interaction between these molecules. Yesterday we have discussed a lot about problematic chemical reactions or the sticking phenomenon of John Bohn between two bialkali ground state molecules. Now, the question is, what happens if we spin polarize our rubidium strontium ground state molecules? If they encounter each other, then the intermolecular potential will have a repulsive contribution from the exchange interaction. And the question is, will this repulsive contribution help us such that the two molecules don't encounter each other at short range? We can also tune the long range interaction between these molecules using radio frequency dressing and create electron spin dependent long range interaction, a little bit related to what Alexei was talking about yesterday. And this would then be a way to create quantum simulators of lattice spin models. Okay, so you see, it should be interesting to study these molecules. Let's go to the lab and try to create them. That brings me to the overview of my talk. I'll first tell you how we created our strontium Bose-Einstein condensate, and this gives me an occasion to introduce you to the important properties of strontium and our experimental techniques. Then I will tell you how we create the rubidium strontium double BEC, and at the end, I'll show you how we create strontium 2 molecules. Okay, so people have been interested in strontium since a long time because it's very interesting for precision measurement, for the construction of optical clocks. And these groups have always tried a little bit also to create a strontium BEC. For example, Katori's group in 2000 already created an ultra-cold sample of strontium 88 with a phase-based density of 0.1. And Tino's group in Florence in 2006 created a strontium 88-86 mixture with a similar phase-based density. And if you look at these phase-based densities, you have the impression you need to just tweak your experiments a little bit and you have a BEC. But it wasn't quite that easy. And why is that? Let's take a look at the table of all bosonic isotopes. So if you work, if you start an experiment, you would probably first choose strontium 88 because it has this high natural abundance. But as we know today, the scattering length of strontium 88 is minus 2 Bohr, so these atoms don't thermalize and you can forget about evaporative cooling. Strontium 86 has the opposite problem. Its scattering length is so large that you suffer from a huge amount of three-body decay, and evaporation is also very hard. And then there's poor and forgotten strontium 84, and it was probably never mentioned in these old works because the natural abundance is only 0.5%. But in Innsbruck, we also have an experiment where we study lithium-6-potassium-40 mixtures, and potassium-40 has a natural abundance of only 0.01%. And we can still work with it, in that case, because we can just buy enriched potassium-40. So I wasn't too afraid of this low natural abundance. I asked Roman Cirillo, a theorist, if he could calculate the scattering length of strontium 84 by mass scaling the known scattering lengths of the other isotopes. And like 3 days later, he came back to me and said, the scattering length should be around 124 Bohr. And that's right in the Goldilocks range of scattering lengths which you would wish for if you want to perform evaporative cooling. So I said, yes, let's try to make a BEC of strontium 84. Evidently, there is still the problem of no natural abundance, but I will show you in a second how we get around that. So we constructed a machine. Here you see the central part of our vacuum chamber. This is the fluorescence of the strontium mod. And the secret to overcome this low natural abundance lies in a property of this mod. And to understand this, I show you here again the level scheme. So the first laser cooling stage operates on this broad line with transition. We have a few strontium atoms, but not many. And one of the reasons is because we are using here this low abundance isotope. Now, this transition has a special property. It's not a closed transition. And for once, we are happy that it's not a closed transition, because these atoms can escape down to the 3p2 meter stable state. And this state is magnetic. It can be trapped in the quadrupole magnetic field, which we have anyways present for the operation of our magneto-optical trap. And the lifetime is on the order of minutes. We have a good vacuum, so we can just accumulate more and more atoms in this state. And after about 10 seconds, we have plenty enough atoms to make a BEC. We have completely overcome the issue of low natural abundance. Now we make use of another nice property of strontium. We pump these atoms back down to the ground state and capture them in a second mod, which is running on this very narrow intercombination line. It has a line width of only 7.4 kilohertz, and it allows us to cool these atoms to the microkelvin regime, and also the density is increased a lot. And if we load these atoms now to an optical dipole trap, we have already achieved a phase-based density of 0.1. And you have to compare this with the phase-based density which you could reach in alkali atoms at a similar stage in the experimental sequence. That would be 10 to the minus 5. So it's really great what we can do here. And it's a similar phase-based density which Cartori had, of course, with strontium 88. Now we have strontium 84, which has can collide elastically, so we can perform evaporative cooling, and so we made a strontium BEC. Since we start with a high phase-based density, we don't lose many atoms during the evaporation. Only 3/4 of our atoms are gone, and our BECs can be really big, 10 million atoms in the BEC. So since then, we have developed methods with which we can bring all isotopes of strontium and some of their mixtures to quantum degeneracy. And recently, we were even able to create a strontium BEC by using laser cooling as the only cooling mechanism. In that experiment, we still use elastic collisions to thermalize the sample, but we don't waste atoms by evaporating them. Okay, now Our goal is to create rubidium strontium molecules. For that, we evidently need rubidium, and therefore we extended our apparatus during the last months with rubidium. And I now want to show you how we create our rubidium strontium double BEC. And here I will tell you only a very, very simplistic, a simplified scheme of it. In reality, it's way more complicated, and you can come to me after the talk and I'll give you all the dirty details. But now, very simple scheme is we prepare a rubidium mod, load the rubidium into an optical dipole trap, and actually here rubidium is quite hot, 30 microkelvin. That's typical temperature for rubidium in a dipole trap. Then we prepare strontium just in the way I described before, and load the strontium atoms also into the optical dipole trap. And now comes the nice step in this experimental sequence. We continue to laser cool strontium in the optical dipole trap, and by elastic collisions, it sympathetically cools down the rubidium as well, just like Deep told us before with lithium and ytterbium. But here we are really profiting from this narrow intercombination line of strontium, and we can go very far in phase space density. You see, we start with something like 10 to the minus 4, and we go to nearly 0.1. We have an increase of a factor 200 in phase space density here. And after this, we are left with two samples, rubidium and strontium, both very close to phase, to quantum degeneracy, and we have to perform only a little tiny bit of evaporative cooling, and here we are. We have a double BEC. In this case, we chose to have a mixture of rubidium in all three MF states of the F equals 1 hyperfine ground state, and we separate them for demonstration purposes with a magnetic field gradient on these images. Okay, now we are a step closer towards these rubidium strontium molecules, and if we would have a B-alkali mixture, the next step evidently would be to use a magnetic Feshbach resonance to associate these molecules. And when we started this research, it was not at all clear if there would be magnetic Feshbach resonances in our system. And so I asked Jeremy and others about his opinion on this question. And a few months later, Jeremy came back to me with a very nice present. Just on my birthday, he submitted this article to the archive and to PRL. So ultra-cold rubidium strontium molecules can be formed by magneto-association. So what a great birthday present. And so we at least have one strategy to form these molecules. Evidently, as he described it to us yesterday, these magnetic Feshbach resonances might be quite narrow. So it's still worthwhile to look out for an alternative technique to form these rubidium strontium ground state molecules. And the alternative technique which we are using is association of the molecules, of the atoms to molecules using stirrup. And we demonstrated this technique by producing strontium 2 molecules. Strontium atoms, of course, also don't have magnetic Feshbach resonances among each other because there's no electric magnetic moment in the ground state. Okay, so this brings me to the last part of my talk. How do we make these molecules? It's very simple. We create a Bose-Einstein condensate of strontium, load the Bose-Einstein condensate into an optical lattice in such a way that we have plenty of sites that are occupied by exactly two atoms. And these two atoms in the ground state of the lattice well form a well-defined initial state for a stirrup sequence. And our stirrup lasers couple this initial state to a final molecular state, which in our case has a binding energy of 640 megahertz, through an intermediate molecular state here in the molecular potential, which belongs to one atom optically excited on the intercombination line. Okay, and this stirrup scheme here profits from the fact that we are using this narrow intercombination line. For example, the decay rate from this optically excited molecular potential is quite weak, which means we have plenty of time to perform our stirp. We do it in 100 microseconds. And that means we can perform this stirp with weak lasers. We can also easily resolve the band structure of our lattice, so our molecules are really formed in the lowest state of the lattice well after this stirrup process. Good. So we perform stirrup. We start with laser 2 switched on. The two atoms in this ground state of the lattice form the dark state. Then we slowly ramp on the laser 1 and ramp off laser 2. The system stays in the dark state, which evolves. It becomes a superposition of state A and M, and goes finally to the molecular state, which is a dark state if only laser 1 is present. And here's the experimental data. Here you have we detect the atom number. Always, we never detect molecules. And what's shown here is the atom number we detect while we are performing the stirrup sequence here. And you see the atom number goes down. This is because molecules are formed. At the end of the stirrup sequence, we still have quite a few atoms left. And the reason for that is that in our optical lattice, also many sites are occupied by just one atom. And those atoms evidently can't form a molecule. We get rid of these atoms by a strong blast of resonant light. And afterwards, we don't see any atoms anymore. Now we perform stirrup in the inverse direction. That converts molecules back to atoms, and we see the atomic signal coming back up again. OK, and from these data, we can extract that we had a molecule conversion efficiency in single pass of 30% in these first experiments. And it's probably limited by the lifetime of our molecules. We measured a lifetime of only 60 microseconds, which must be due to some technical issues, which we plan to resolve once we go to the rubidium-strontium molecule production. OK, so that's where we are. Now we have to bring together these different topics. We have our rubidium-strontium double BC. We have two different methods, at least. I mean, your metastable state method would be the third, to form rubidium-strontium ground state molecules. And after we have formed weakly bound molecules, we would use a second stirrup process to go to the absolute ground state. And then we are there, and we can examine all the nice chemistry and not so nice chemistry, and hopefully go to the study of many-body physics using these interesting molecules. OK, and let me at the end thank my team. So Simon Stelmer was a great PhD student who built up this experiment together with me, and he recently defended. Benjamin is a really great and very hardworking postdoc. And actually, it's already the second talk with results from Benjamin, which you see today, because Bruno also showed a lot of results of Benjamin's PhD. Alex and Slava are PhD students who recently joined us. Florian Vogel is a master's student. And without the support of Rudy, none of this would have been possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Florian. Questions?
Florian, when you mix your BEC, the strontium and rubidium BECs actually mixed. Have you studied anything about their mixing properties? Are they miscible? And have you learned anything about the interaction properties or scattering lengths of the interspecies scattering length?
Yeah. Okay. So we are currently studying we are performing photoassociation spectroscopy of rubidium with strontium. We have found our first line just 10 days ago. And we will soon do two-photon photoassociation spectroscopy to figure out where the last bound state is. And then I can answer your question precisely. Now I have a rough answer to your question. We have the suspicion that strontium-84 and rubidium-87 are not miscible. We deduce this from the fact that our strontium BEC seems to be pushed around a little bit in time-of-flight images, and also squished a little bit as soon as we have the rubidium BEC present. We also, I didn't tell you that, we can perform evaporative cooling of strontium 88 and rubidium 87. We can also make a double BEC of those two isotopes, and that means the interspecies scattering lengths of these two isotopic mixtures are both in a reasonable range, with which I mean between 50 bor and 300 bor, something like this. Now we do know the mass scaling behavior of the interspecies scattering lengths, and if you plug this information in, say 84 and rubidium is a little bit higher than 100 bor, which would lead to immiscibility, and the other one a little bit lower, then you see that at least strontium 87, the fermionic isotope, and rubidium would be just nice 50 bor, something like this, and that means we can use those two guys to make our molecules, because in the simple strategy, we would form a double quantum degenerate mixture, strontium and rubidium, it should be miscible, and then we loaded it on an optical lattice. And evidently, we want to have one atom of each element per lattice site, and that only works if the interspecies scattering length is smaller than the intraspecies scattering length of both isotopes. So I have some hope that this will be possible with a fermionic strontium isotope, and actually, that might be even the most interesting one, because then we can make fermionic molecules, and there we have much more possibilities to stabilize them against inelastic processes.
So I really just wanted to follow up on that. So what was the evidence that the interspecies scattering length is not very large for the 87, 84?
This is extremely indirect, and this is completely preliminary what I'm saying here. It's just that we seem to have indications that strontium 84 and rubidium 87 are not miscible, which means that their interspecies scattering lengths must be above 100 bor.
Yeah, but why can't it be 1,000?
It could.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay, I thought you said.
I mean, let me see. No, 1,000. Then I would expect to have large three-body decay, and we don't see this.
Okay, so it's the lack of three-body decay that means that it's large rather than very large. That's the bit. I wanted to get. Is there any information on the sign?
Could I deduce this? Yeah, I mean, if it would be negative, I would not see our rubidium BC pushed around in space.
No, I mean, in the ytterbium 174, there was phase separation, which was interpreted by Paul with a diffusion mechanism.
Yeah.
And at that point, they couldn't rule out the possibility of a large negative scattering length.
But that was because the scattering length was really huge.
It was really large, yeah. Yeah, so probably it's got to be, yeah, okay. Mm. That's enough to get fairly good ideas of locations of Feshbach resonances and things, so mm-hmm. We should do that.
Yeah. I hope in a few weeks we will have the two photon spectroscopy done, and you will be one of the first to know the result.
A question for both you, Florian and Tanya. The strontium molecule, the atomic, could be also used for testing the violation of the Pauli principle, right?
With both principle? I didn't get the
Pauli principle, both the 88 as well as the 84 isotope, because in both cases the nuclear spin is zero. Mm-hmm. So there should be a blatant absence of some rotational states. These species. Any thoughts how strontium would compare with, say, CO2, on which such tests had been done by Madunio and company and other people?
I don't have information on this. Tanya, do you have anything on that?
Testing actually the Pauli principle for bosons, the nuclei. It's been tested for fermions very accurately, but not for bosons exactly. Well, there should be an absence of rotational states, right? Because they cannot be populated.
You mean testing the forbidden transitions from, you know, some between various angular momentum states, or
right,
two photon transitions?
No single photon transitions. Oh. This should be absent. They just cannot occur.
Oh, testing for absence of transitions?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Paul.
Yes, there was such an experiment attempted at NIST several years ago by Dan Kellerer using the O16 molecule, which would have missing lines, and he was looking for the possible existence of the missing lines, you know, one of these high-precision tests. The experiment was never completed and finished, so it never had any conclusions.
Well, there are nevertheless theories, for instance, by Greenberg at the University of Maryland, that are exploring the possibilities of having, you know, a world where not only bosons and fermions exist, but it does not give any number on, you know, on the violation, on finding an anti-symmetric system in a symmetric state, or the other way around.
Yeah, sorry, we sort of strayed from strontium 2, but to continue on this thread, there actually were a couple of experiments completed, one like the one that Paul talked about, looking for, so again, the idea is, let's say you have a truly homonuclear molecule with two of the same nuclei, two of the same atoms, then there are, for a singlet sigma G state, there are no odd rotational levels just because of the spin statistics. So yeah, there have been experiments that were completed like that one. There was one by Bob Hilborn at Amherst College, and I think Guillermo Tino also completed an experiment like that. And Madunio, yeah, that's right. So there are limits set on, you know, non-existence of spin statistics violating molecular states. If I recall, they're at the 10 to the minus 8 level, something like that. So for bosons, yeah. Yeah, that's right. For fermions, it's much more accurate. For bosons, it's at the 10 to the minus 8 level. I suspect just it'd be hard to do that well with so few molecules, but.
Sorry, can I make one comment? So actually, NH3 has a missing level as well, but I don't see what cold molecules have anything to help you there, because I think you need large number of molecules and not necessarily high precision. But anyway, if I can have another question for Florian. it's very technical maybe, but if you do this for strontium 84, does this mean that your experiment gets much slower? Do you have a much lower duty cycle, or compared to other experiments? Well, if you do this accumulation,
yeah,
and the fact that you have so little atoms in this right state, does this mean that your experiments get much slower, or you have a lower duty cycle? Or?
Not necessarily. So we can optimize on our experiment on duty cycle if we just want to produce a strontium 84 BEC, and if we are happy with 500,000 atoms, then we can do this every 2 seconds, all included. Yeah.
I was wondering about, do you have any clues why the lifetime of the molecule is so short?
We looked at it for 2 days or so, playing around with the intensity of the lattice lasers and the infrared dipole trap lasers, which were on at the same time, and we didn't find anything. I believe it's technical, because Tanya's molecules live much longer, don't they? And yeah, you see, it must be some dirt effect. It can be some resonant light, which we didn't filter away correctly from the stirrup lasers. We do know that we excite atoms to the higher motional band in our lattice during this process so far. And this is probably just dirt. We need to filter our stirrup lasers by a nice cavity to get rid of light in the wings. I mean, these lasers are not far detuned from resonant transitions, just a few hundred megahertz, and there's amplified spontaneous emission in our laser beams and so on.
So one final question.
Okay, Florian, I had a question about your molecule production in the lattice with the stirrup and the low efficiency. Is this related to the very small Frank-Condon factor on the up leg because of the large volume of the lattice cell, or the multiplicity of levels in the lattice, or just something like light scattering that's limiting your lifetimes?
Yeah, it's a lifetime. Our stirrup process takes 100 microseconds. The lifetime of our molecule is 60 microseconds, so they decay while they are born. And if we would not have this limited lifetime, then you would have a very high efficiency. Like, I think we can solve this problem. Stirrup, but not to amplified spontaneous emission photons, for example. If you have an incoherent photon hitting your dark state, then it can be excited out of the dark state. No?
Well, I think it's time to close this session, and let's do so by thanking all the speakers again.